Hi. Just a brief disclosure for today's podcast episode. Our guest is Michelle White, senior curator at the Manil Collection here in Houston. She is not affiliated with UBS and her views are her own. Enjoy the show. Hello. Welcome to another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking, the podcast series by the Young Walk with Sauer team at UBS in Houston, Texas. I am your host, Liz Demontron. I'm one of the financial advisors on the team. For compliance purposes, our team's phone number is 713-940-2827. As always, I'm very happy to be here. And I am joined today by none other than Barry Young, another financial advisor on our team. Hi, Barry.
How you doing?
Good. You ready to do another podcast?
I'm ready in the podcast bunker here. Yeah.
Yeah, with our UBS wallpaper. Well, we are thrilled to welcome today's guest. She is another repeat guest on the podcast, although admittedly, last time she was on, we were stuck recording over the phone due to some COVID protocols. We also had to record that episode twice, which is a story for another time. But we're so excited to welcome the gracious and brilliant Michelle White, senior curator at the Manil Collection in Houston. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for having me. I've enjoyed our morning coffee over seeing all of your art here in the offices. It's so impressive and exciting, including many Robert Rauschenbergs.
Yes. Well, we hope to talk to you a little bit about Rauschenberg today, but it was great to have you come through on the rapid fire art walk here this morning. I am excited that like some of the pieces in our collection kind of overlap with what's in the Manil Collection.
They do, absolutely.
I hadn't really thought about it until your presence here, and we're very grateful to have you in person. And I did listen to the last podcast where you were dialing in, and Liz and I were at a meeting the other day, and we had a nice shout out from our client about that particular episode. So,
fantastic.
Our one listener, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I will say, I mean, you know, we're here today to catch up with you, hear what's going on at the Manil, you know, talk specifically about an exhibition that you've been working, you know, very closely on for a long time. But there's talk. I mean, Barry and I are hearing so much buzz about this upcoming exhibition. So we're so excited to talk to you about, you know, what you've been working on recently. Would you mind sharing more?
Sure.
About the exhibition?
So in the fall, we will open an exhibition on the work of Robert Rauschenberg. And we're thrilled to do this because it's a celebration of a Texas artist. Many people don't know that Robert Rauschenberg was born in Port Arthur, and he was born in 1925. So this is his 100th year. And museums around the country, around Europe, will also be celebrating his centennial this year. So we're part of a larger celebration, and we really wanted to participate with an exhibition to also draw attention to Rauschenberg's ties to Texas and also the Manil's ties to Rauschenberg.
This won't be the first Rauschenberg show in Houston. There was a really big retrospective in 98. Is that right?
Correct.
And what in particular about this show is going to be different from, you know, the past? And there's I think 87 works in the permanent collection.
We have a lot of Rauschenbergs because the Diminils were champions of Rauschenberg early on in his career, beginning in the 60s when they started collecting works on paper by Rauschenberg, which they would go on to do through the opening of the Manil Collection. And it wasn't just one show. When Walter Hopps, our founding director, took the reins of the institution in the 1980s, he had worked with Rauschenberg extensively beginning in the late 1950s. So with Walter Hopps came a really extraordinary mind who helped within scholarship think through Rauschenberg's importance and did so during his lifetime. So Walter Hopps did three exhibitions of Rauschenberg's work at the Manil Collection. So this show, this upcoming show, very much continues that conversation and that lineage of focused exhibitions that take one aspect of Rauschenberg's work in a way that hasn't been done before.
The body of work over such a long time is almost overwhelming, and he changed, you know, media so quite frequently, almost like went along for a while and then abruptly changed. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is, like, Dominique de Manil had, you know, background in science and technology, and, you know, relative to the attraction around collecting Rauschenberg, and I think they were friends, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Did that have something to do with it? Because he was involved in the experimental art and technology projects, you know, the early 60s. And I have a couple of questions about that, but I thought maybe there was some kind of connection there.
Well, it is a beautiful connection, and I'll attribute that to the fact that both Dominique de Manil and Robert Rauschenberg had deeply curious minds. And for Robert Rauschenberg, when we think about his place within art history, mm-hmm. where he distinguishes his practice is that he was one of the first artists to really think through this multidisciplinary, multimedia, cross examination of bringing different parts and different aspects from science to a variety of materials to his work. It's something that we take for granted now within contemporary artistic practice, but Rauschenberg was one of the first artists to do that. Even in the 1960s, when he was thinking about the space between painting and sculpture, and how could you make a work that combines those two categories, which became the combine paintings. Mm-hmm. And he did this throughout his lifetime. And it's a quality I'd like to think very much is aligned with how Mrs. de Manil saw the world.
I mean, Rauschenberg, he's one of our own from Port Arthur. I've been to Port Arthur. Did you go and visit? I know you went to Captiva. So on those visits, what did you discover?
I'm just back from a trip to Captiva mm-hmm. Island, where Rauschenberg made his home beginning in the late 1960s. But I have also been to Port Arthur, which is about an hour and a half drive here from Houston. And I went with my colleagues at the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation, and we visited the site of his house. It's no longer there. It's an empty lot. We visited local museum professionals from the Museum of the Gulf Coast mm-hmm. who had fond recollections of Rauschenberg, who would return throughout his life, and the public library there, which keeps an incredible file that has chronicled the life of his family, specifically his mother early on in the 50s and 60s. So yes, it absolutely, being there shows how far Rauschenberg came and his origins, and you start to see that extensively throughout his work, especially towards the end of his life.
I thought it was interesting he returned to the Gulf Coast. I mean,
yeah.
Look, Captiva is not Port Arthur, you know.
Captiva is no Port Arthur, but it's watery and the light and the
right.
The climate, absolutely. There's a conversation happening.
And he seemed to draw some inspiration, which I think will be represented in a show. And I wanted to talk about that. But I read this quote from him, and I wanted to get your response. And I'm not sure what the context of this is, but it kind of jumped out at me. And he said, to quote Rauschenberg, "Being right can stop all the momentum of a very interesting idea." What does that mean to you?
I think it's an amazing quote. We should have it on t-shirts
I agree.
In all corporate offices.
And I agree. And we were talking about like sitting at the crossroads of idea generation and, you know, how art and, you know, sort of finance go together. And, you know, in some ways they do, in some ways they don't. But with respect to failure, and I hope you'll riff a little bit about failure as a theme with not only Rauschenberg, but like what artists risk.
Right. Or maybe not so much failure as accepting life is messy
mm-hmm.
and it's not neat and there's spaces in between. And for Rauschenberg, this is fundamental to his work. As he said early on in his career, that he was seeking the space between life and art. That is a space filled with risks. And he was seeking out this place, this liminal space that could defy categorization, that could defy terms. And he did this through his approach to materials. He did this in kind of thinking through work that could essentially disrupt how we think of artistic categories. And it's
a lovely concept that still is extremely relevant and valid today. And this idea of failure, I also think applies to how Rauschenberg thought through art as something that could challenge the way we see the world, that could challenge tradition, right? That's mm-hmm. a type of failure in presumptions about how something should be in the world. And his art does that.
This idea of inherent messiness, I think, you know, when you've described the exhibition, you know, this focus of Rauschenberg's work with fabric, I think you've used the term indeterminate. Is there a link there between kind of this messiness and the way Rauschenberg views his life and then also this fluidity, this kind of variance, this almost theatricality, I think, that can come with cloth and with fabric?
Absolutely. That is key to the argument of the exhibition. And so as Rauschenberg came of age and as he gets recognized art historically for his importance, beginning especially towards the mid-1960s, the press is calling him the most important artist since Jackson Pollock. And part of this recognition comes, again, because he's crossing over these mediums and the sort of specificity between what constitutes a print, what constitutes a painting, what constitutes a sculpture. So he was never an artist, say, that focused on a particular material or medium. But what happens in the 1970s is what I'm pulling out for this show is that he very much begins to focus on fabric. And it's not just fabric that's pushed against a canvas or used as a surface for making a painting, but it's fabric that comes to the fore as itself. And what I've been trying to do over the past 2 years working with the foundation, writing this book, is to think through what is so different about fabric. And that is really where I land, that fabric in itself is an inherently indeterminate thing in the world. It's soft. It cloaks the body. It doesn't behave according to the rules, right? It's not stiff. It's not solid. It has this in-betweenness that, of course, is key to Rauschenberg's work, but it's an in-betweenness that alone is embodied in this particular material, fabric. And I love that about it. And I love this work because there's moments in these sculptural pieces that we will be showing where fabric is just itself. It's a swath of suspended silk. Nothing's on it. Nothing's painted on it. It's not adorned. It's just sort of attached in a way to the wall or a pole or propped in a particular configuration that just allows it to be. And it's stunningly beautiful.
That the fabric element, I mean, it's a through line for his whole life. I mean, his mother was a seamstress. I picked that up, I think, from reading the preview the programming. And I mean, you know, you can't help but make that connection. The other sort of point of reference was that I had to look up was the Pelican work where he was using parachute material, I guess, because, you know, post-war, and it was also part of a performance piece. So, I mean, when I read about it, I'm like, I gotta see if I can find a picture of this. But it's really interesting. And that was in the 61. So I guess prior to that, he made dresses. Yes?
Well, yes. And you bring up a really important part of this story. So through the lens of looking at this body of work from the 1970s, the fabric work, which is what this show's about, we've been able to, within the research and the book we've published, to look back at his earlier work. And what happens is suddenly through the lens of fabric, all of these aspects of his biography become quite clear. But what you're bringing up about his interest in fashion design is fascinating because it's an aspect of his biography that mm-hmm. very few have touched upon. And we really wanted to bring this out. Within the Minnell archives, we were able to even dig around because we have a group of correspondents from one of his close friends in Port Arthur here in Houston. And what we discovered in that correspondence, too, that he was incredibly invested and interested in a career as a fashion designer. Prior to joining the Navy early on. He studied pharmacology at UT Austin, which also very few people know about. And he goes to the Navy. And while he's serving in the Navy, he writes back to UT Austin and asks about studying fashion design. And this is within our book, within the scholarship. This is the first time this is coming to the fore. And the dean writes back to him and says, you know, like, we don't really have a formal fashion design program, and you're welcome to study, but it would be in home economics, and you'd have to be in courses with all women.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh. So he goes on, whether or not that was the reason, with the GI Bill following his service in the Navy, to the Kansas City Art Institute. And there he formally studies fashion design.
Sidebar, did he change his name?
He did change his name. He was born Milton Rauschenberg.
I mean, there's a lot of questions around that, but there was some instruction at Black Mountain where I think he took textile class from Annie Albers.
Yeah. I mean, part of Rauschenberg's education after studying in Kansas City, after serving in the Navy, is he goes on to Black Mountain College, which at the time was such an important site for the formation of post-war American avant-garde. And while he was there, he was studying with artists like Joseph Albers, mm-hmm. Annie Albers. He was a student alongside Merce Cunningham, which he will go on to have extensive work with in terms of the world of dance.
John Cage.
I mean, the list goes on and on of the artists in Rauschenberg's orbit. Of course, also, there was Cy Twombly, there was Jasper Johns, and this was instrumental to the formation of his work in the 1950s. But of course, at Black Mountain, one of the core tenets of the curriculum was this cross-disciplinary mm-hmm. understanding, which is, you know, where we get that he did study weaving with Annie Albers, and he took courses in experimental dance and music. Like, this is what becomes the American avant-garde and becomes why Rauschenberg, as he enters the art world after Black Mountain, is so impactful to art history.
Yeah, I mean, so many questions about this came up for me, but I have to ask about the dress, going back to the dressmaking and just the constant, you know, through line of, you know, fabric and the work. And even when you walked into our office, you pointed out the fabric of the collage that we have hanging in our foyer that I didn't even, you know, realize it was there. And, you know, is there any kind of like feminist overtone there in that work, a theme that he's hitting on? And perhaps you could address that.
I love that question. It's complicated. And it also,
I have two daughters. Of course, I'm going to ask
well,
that question.
And it also, this question around indeterminacy, which Liz, you brought up in terms of fabric being this mm-hmm. space in between, fabric being a material that doesn't follow all the rules, that's fluid, right? Like, well, let's think
also,
about that metaphorically.
You know, the time and place, you know, the 60s, you know, as a catalyst for change and second wave feminism. And like, I can't not help but think this is on his mind.
Absolutely. And that's also part of the conversation I bring up in the essay for this book, is that with the fabric works of the 1970s, we very much can pull Rauschenberg into these conversations about fabric as a material that's a little bit subversive,
right?
Because it's not
that's
the types mm-hmm. of things that within a masculine modernist art history, artists are making with, especially when you think about where he's coming out of abstract expressionism, where you're making these big gestural paintings.
Macho, right, yeah.
On canvas, or you're making welded steel sculptures. Fabric in its inherent association to domesticity is feminine, right? It's of that mm-hmm. realm. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's precisely why in second wave feminist art production or the women's art movement that you're referencing, fabric becomes a really important material in terms of making, because it carries that history, it carries that weight, that symbolic association to this sphere that has typically stood outside of art history. So while Rauschenberg never directly talked about this, this is certainly really interesting. And also in terms of fashion design, and as an artist whose sexuality was, while not...
fluid, yeah.
No, but he was... but as a queer artist,
yeah,
while he didn't necessarily discuss it as informing his art production, certainly he's standing outside of traditions, ways of being in the world, in a time when that was certainly political.
Yeah. So as it pertains to the Manil's legacy, I have to ask this question too, is did he interface with Charles James?
That's a really good question. Likely not based on the timetable. I'd have to look specifically at the years of Charles James's involvement, but that was in the late 40s, early 1950s. Mm-hmm. So it would not have crossed paths. And to go back to this idea of Rauschenberg and fashion, it's never really been discussed. It's an aspect, again, of his biography that just hasn't come up that much. But that's also part of the way history has been written, the way especially modernist art history has been written. It's hard to kind of wrap your head around an artist who's considered the most important artist since Jackson Pollock and reconcile his interest, say, in designing couture gowns.
Mm-hmm. I think you were almost getting to the point, but going back to the feminist element, why is it taking so long for someone to, you know, pick up on this theme? And I'm just assuming that it's your curatorial genius, but it seems like an obvious question to ask given the lineage of using this material throughout his entire career.
It's literally soup to nuts.
I mean, it's a, from his mom being a seamstress, you know, to the, you know, to the sales.
As a curator, it's so fun to be able to think through an artist like Rauschenberg and think about new ways of thinking about his importance in art history or what he was doing differently. And for Rauschenberg, it can be really daunting. There's so much that's been written about him. There's so many books. There's been so many shows. There's been so many shows at my institution. So it's been really exciting to partake in this project because you realize even with an artist so well known, there's so many different ways to think about their work and to think through how new scholarship can be done. And this is,
you know, and you've probably seen shows, you know, when you go to a museum and you see a show in one of my favorite occupations, but, you know, sometimes the theme is thin or it's obscure, but this theme is dense. I mean, it's like almost overwhelming. And so it's like, it's kind of like the elephant, you know, in the career. I mean, did you get that sense when you were doing your scholar on this project?
Well, Barry, I'd like to think all of my shows are dense.
Yeah.
But no, I wasn't referring
to your shows.
I appreciate that. I think that's a great compliment. But yes, as I was...
It's a big theme. It's not a small, obscure path here. I mean, this is something that is like you're mining through decades. And I
think it's also... hopefully interesting, too, when you think about, like, what does it mean to show work from the 1970s in 2025? What can this work still say to us? How can it still be relevant? And I do think these questions around how fabric operates and how it occupies, again, this very, like, fertile, interesting space in between, I very much hope can still be exciting for viewers to think through or to spark conversations around this. And it really is the best compliment.
That's good. You're welcome. But that's a good segue because I want to play a game with you. I want to do a little artist association. So I just want you to riff on sort of what dialogue contemporary artists are having with Rauschenberg. You can freestyle it. So here's my list. It was Melvin Edwards. This is just what came to me after looking at some of the works. Melvin Edwards, Christian Marclay seemed very obvious. Jamal Cyrus, Deborah Roberts, Cindy Sherman.
Well, I think we have a show.
Yeah. I think we should.
All of it. I think your list can go
well,
on.
Well, I mean, those are, I'm the dilettante here. So, I mean, what contemporary work do you think are having a direct dialogue with Rauschenberg? That's kind of what I'm getting at. Maybe it's too broad of a question.
Direct is hard because I also feel like Rauschenberg's work has been so impactful to the formation of what becomes contemporary art as we know it today, that there's things that we take for granted that are so Rauschenberg that almost seem that they're a given. Again, like I was saying, this idea of like mixing materials, mixing ideas of printmaking and drawing, it's so fundamental to how we see art production now that it feels almost too broad to connect to Rauschenberg. The fabric works of the 1970s, what's really interesting about them in terms of your question about impact or influence or how they've sort of shaped the work of artists today is also a great question, because what's so interesting about these works is that when Rauschenberg started showing these in the 1970s, he was 50 years old. He's had this tremendous fame and attention. And in many reviews that we've put together and have been part of our research, he was essentially panned for these works. Critics did not like them. They thought they were vapid. They thought they were too minimalist. They thought they lacked the sort of guts and grime of his previous work that most often involved the use of urban detritus. These were clean. They were fresh. They had these sort of sensual sail-like qualities that were so different than what Rauschenberg had done before. As a consequence of that, the works have just not been shown very much. This is the first museum exhibition to focus on the fabric works of the 1970s. So your question is really fascinating and one I've also had, but it's one that I've recognized that I don't know if enough artists have been able to see these series of works in a way that would directly impact their practice. And that's why I'm also excited about the show, because here we have this moment, this chance, this opportunity to bring this work to the attention of many artists. And let's see what happens.
What's so interesting to think about as well, I think, is the presentation of something like fabric. Are there controls in place that y'all have to standardize the viewing experience to make it as similar as a viewer looking at it in the 1970s? Things like certain AC levels or making sure people don't, you know, I'm thinking about some, like, you're kind of exposed to the elements a little bit, but how much whimsy is introduced and how much control is maintained?
Oh, that's a good question. Do you mean in terms of thinking through how the artist would have had exhibited them in that decade?
Yes. And how you guys are thinking about the presentation as well.
So for a lot of these works, specifically, there's a series called The Jammers. And these are the works that are about the sort of unadorned swaths of fabric that he often affixes on the wall, sometimes with tacks, sometimes with a leaning rattan pole. Very simple in construction. And in Rauschenberg's lifetime, and when they were first shown in the 1970s, he did detailed plans of how they should be installed to the degree of the angle of the pole that props up the swath of yellow silk, for example. Wow. So with that information and with the hands-on support of the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation, where many of these loans are coming from, we know exactly how the works would have been shown. And that's what we use as our starting point to install the work. So when you see these works, they will be installed as the artist intended.
Wow. What about like staging? How do you think about what the pacing, what the visual pacing of the show is and how all the different pieces are going to fit together? It sounds like there's some different movements, different eras within this. You know, how do you think about putting the whole puzzle together?
Yeah, it's always a challenge and also a really fun part about exhibition making. And at the museum, we work with a scale model. It's 1/12 scale. So we make all of the works, mini versions of the works. And I spend a lot of time with our exhibition designer, moving things around, thinking about flow, thinking about conversations between pieces, and how you as the viewer will walk through the space and what kind of story you will hopefully absorb as you're moving through this story of Rauschenberg's fabric works. So all decisions are incredibly deliberate. And for this installation, because of some of these pieces are quite large, sometimes they sit in the middle of the room. We're thinking a lot about movement and the choreography of the space, how walls help us that we will build for the show, frame and allow these pieces to really be able to shine.
Wow.
How did you decide what works to show relative to the permanent collection and loans? Or you've been working on this a long time.
I have. It's been about a 3-year process. And in thinking about the fabric works, there's probably over 1,000 examples that could have been in a show. And I think that's something to think about when you go into any exhibition. A huge part about curating is editing what you decide to actually put on the checklist and to put on the wall, and what works tell that story in the best way. So for these, it was really thinking through the most powerful examples, the most beautiful examples, the biggest, the strongest, the works that could take us through the myriad of approaches he took to working with fabric. So ensuring there was a variety of types of cloth, different ways, works that show different ways that he would have attached the fabric to the walls. So to represent that really diverse understanding of different types of materials. So I wanted to showcase that with limited space. So I think there's 40 works in the show. How do they represent this larger corpus is always the challenge.
I don't know how you edit it.
And then on top of that, we also have to make sure we can borrow the loans.
Yeah.
And we are so grateful to so many institutions in the United States who said yes. So we have loans from the Guggenheim, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, among others who have worked closely with us to make this
happen. And we have some local collectors participating.
We have local collectors.
Amazing.
We have Texas collectors.
You could take one of ours home with you if you want.
Thank you. It doesn't fit in my car.
I find the curation of a show like this, I mean, it's an art of itself. You've been at the Manila for 20 years? Yeah? Does it seem like that long?
It's 19.
19? Yeah. The decisions that are made, I know you just recently, you reimagined or reinstalled the Contemporary Gallery, which I would encourage anyone to go see. But one of the things that when I walked through it like 3 or 4 times now, and one of the things that's like very poignant was putting the Deborah Roberts next to the Picasso, where they're both depicting women in a chair. And I'm like, that was kind of like a wow moment for me. And I mean, can you articulate, you know, how you think about those type of decisions? You know, and it also invokes, you know, another work that the museum owns is the Alice Neal, you know, and like it immediately, I mean, immediately it brought to that thought to my mind of how these works over a long span of art history and time are connected.
Well, thank you for seeing that installation. We just opened it in June and it will be up for another year or so. So thank you. And I love working in the permanent collection galleries. Just like creating an exhibition with loans, the biggest challenge or the task is editing, right? I have a lot of work I could put on the walls, but what do you choose? And not only is it about the what, but the how. And at the museum, that how is also how works of art can talk to each other, or how placing, which I did, a Picasso next to the work of a contemporary artist can have a conversation that might help the audience see things differently.
It helped me.
That's amazing. Yeah. Deborah Roberts is an amazing artist that we have in the collection, and that's a new acquisition of
She's Austin-based, right?
She's based in Austin, and she's in her work very much referencing the language of Picasso, and you can see that so clearly when you look at her work. And I thought actually putting a Picasso next to her work will draw out her intention with clarity, and I'm glad you saw that.
Well,
and
it was fun. You definitely nailed that one. What are some other as you think about art having a conversation with other art and conveying those ideas? What other reimagining of the contemporary gallery?
So in the first room of the galleries.
And I love the Nikki de St. Paul's, the sculptures out in the hall.
Oh, thank you. We are thrilled to get out two Nikki de St. Paul's sculptures for the very first time at the museum. They were acquired by Mrs. de Menil for an exhibition at Rice University in 1972. And the exhibition was for children. And these giant, beautiful, boisterous sculptures of a cat and a camel were designed for children to climb all over. And we have these amazing pictures of Houston kids enjoying the St. Paul sculptures. And as a result of that exhibition, we were in a place where they needed extensive conservation in order to exhibit them. And our incredible conservation team embarked on a multi-year project to allow us to show the works for the first time. And Nikki de St. Paul was an American French artist that worked primarily in the 60s and 70s when she became close to the de Menils. So she's an important artist.
Yeah,
for us.
Well, we talked to her on the podcast.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, oh,
that's
4 years ago. Podcast, but a listen.
Yeah. I forgot. The kinetic sculpture
that's out in the hallway, that's like an assemblage type of a piece, right? And it was a collaboration.
That's a collaboration. So that's another piece by Nikki de St. Paul, along with her partner, the Swiss kinetic artist, Jean Tingley.
Yeah, right.
And it's called Monster. And it's this incredible sculpture of gears and paper mache.
You have to hang around to the bottom of the hour, right? Is it the bottom or the top of the hour?
Bottom of the hour.
Bottom of the hour.
We are pushing play and allowing audiences to see the work in action.
It's very cool.
It's a mechanical feat that we're able to exhibit this. And again, another testament to our conservation team.
Am I off, or is that like a little preview of Rauschenberg?
Wait, what is
that? That sculpture reminds me of some of the combines.
Oh, yeah, it does. That is very combine-like. The show will not have combines. Mm-hmm. Combines are from the 1960s primarily. But yes, there's a dialogue, certainly. Right. Yeah. And in fact, my interest in Rauschenberg was really sparked by Nikki de St. Paul. And Rauschenberg and St. Paul worked very closely together in the 1960s, specifically around performances that she did to create.
Okay, so I'm not off.
They were buddies. They were all close.
I appreciate that.
Friends. And the same generation, just a transatlantic friendship that was important. And, you know, Rauschenberg very much worked in Europe quite a bit in those decades.
We want to understand some of the programming around the show, but I can't help myself but ask about recent acquisitions. And, you know, you are very much not entirely responsible, but, you know, help direct those activities at the Menil. And it's not an encyclopedic type of a collecting, but will you tell us a little bit about what recently has been collected? We were talking about Terry Winters earlier. Yeah, just to, you know, what stands out for you
as
a highlight maybe over the last year? I already said the Alice Neal, which is maybe a couple of years old, but
not actually just 2 years. So I oversee our holdings of modern and contemporary art.
Yeah.
And then my colleague, Edward Kopp, oversees the works on paper and the drawings. And I love this aspect of my job is to think through how do we build the collection?
Yeah.
And how do we keep making these conversations on the galleries? Like you mentioned, the relationship between a contemporary artist like Deborah Roberts and Picasso. And we're thinking about that a lot when we make decisions about what artists to bring into the collection. We're very much thinking about how there can be connections between historic parts of the collection. And in fact, in the current iteration of the galleries, one pairing I'm also excited about is that we've recently acquired a work by the Los Angeles painter Christina Quarles.
Mm-hmm.
And Quarles' work very much draws from her interest in the contorted figuration of surrealism in works like by artists like Max Ernst or Roberto Mata. So in that installation, I've also paired Christina Quarles' work with the work of Mata, which is a key artist in our collection from the earlier part of the 20th century. I love that acquisition. I'm very proud of that and making that happen. And most recently, we closed an exhibition in the spring of the work of Tacita Dean.
Right.
The British European artist. This was her first major exhibition in the United States, and she thinks through in a fascinating way the act of drawing as an analog process in our kind of overly digitized virtual way of being. And we made an acquisition of her newest group of drawings that were done on chunks of glass from locomotive era steam train windows.
And then on the programming around the show, I heard you had some special things planned.
We have some very special programs planned for the Rauschenberg show.
A bird told me.
Now, let's go back to fabric, because what we also didn't talk about is we talked about Rauschenberg's aspirations early on to be a fashion designer, how he studied weaving at Black Mountain. But it was at Black Mountain College in the 1950s that he starts working with John Cage and Merce Cunningham. And when he takes on those collaborations, it will yield a lifelong interest in costume design and set design for avant-garde dance productions. So in 1964, Rauschenberg became an artistic director of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company and did costumes and stage sets. And for the centennial, the Cunningham Trust is presenting a special dance event that's traveling around the country, and it brings together a selection of dances that Rauschenberg designed sets and costumes for by not only Merce Cunningham, but also Trisha Brown. And the program is called Dancing with Bob, and it will take place at the Manil Collection, November 14th and 15th, we'll be opening up. It will be a free event, but you will need to reserve tickets, and it will be spectacular. Because another part of this exhibition, which I haven't mentioned yet, is that we're working closely with the Walker Art Center. They have the sets for a particular dance he did with Cunningham in 1977, the height of his work with fabric. And it was a piece called Travelogue, and the sets are called Tantric Geography. And we will be showing those sets as a part of this exhibition. And the related dance performance will contain fragments or pieces from this particular production.
Dancing with Bob. Bob seems like he was a cool guy.
He seemed Bob was a builder.
Yeah.
Bob was a builder. He was a connector.
Yeah.
A dancer, apparently. He loved dancing. And I'll say I'm just back from spending some time on Captiva Island, where the Rauschenberg Foundation has a residency program for artists that is active. So it was extraordinary to be where Rauschenberg lived for so many years, where he worked and made so many of these fabric works, is on the Gulf Coast with the ocean breeze, with sails. He was interested very much
in the type.
Windsurfing plays a huge part of the Jammers, which is a series we will be showing. He was interested in windsurfing, which is about, you know, taking big swaths of fabric and lightweight poles and harnessing the air. So Florida kind of beats very much in the background of all of these works. And it was great being in Florida and seeing how the space that yielded so much of this work is also still a place where artists are thinking through Rauschenberg's legacy and having this extraordinarily creative environment to continue to make work.
Well, as we start wrapping up, we could talk for probably another hour, 2 hours. Barry, unless you have anything, my concluding question is, like you said, there's been so much that's gone into this exhibition, so many works that were surveyed and thought through and then ultimately selected, and different types of works that are ultimately being presented. What is the story? You know, what do you hope people kind of have in their mind as they're walking through the exhibit? What do you hope that their takeaways are, without being too on the nose?
I hope that those who might feel like they're familiar with Rauschenberg's work might see another side of the artist and another facet of his production. And I think and hope the show will provide a broader lens on Rauschenberg's contribution and how it continues to remain relevant today, especially around these questions about the spaces in between.
I just wanted to conclude by thanking you for making the Manila special, and by extension, you know, Houston and our community. We owe you a great debt of thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your support. We owe you a debt of thanks, because if you weren't helping us support shows like these, it would not be possible.
That's a labor of love.
Thank you,
UBS.
No
thanks necessary. We're glad to have you come on in person this time.
Mm-hmm.
We hope to have you come again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Michelle. This has been another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking. We have Liz, Barry, and Michelle signing off.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.